Welcome back to another episode of our brand new podcast, City Hall Pass, hosted by myself, the counsel to the mayor, Kapel Longani. We created this forum, the first of its kind in New York City, to provide you, the general public, with a unique window into the problem-solving process at the highest levels of our city government, and to be able to share insights into key decisions as told by the trailblazing leaders who made them. And now I want to introduce my two guest hosts today, two women who are truly brilliant and inspire me every day, Bess Chu and Kate Coughlin.
Thanks, Kapel. Happy to be here. This is Bess Chu. I'm currently Chief of Staff to the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
Hi, I'm Kate Coughlin, and I currently serve as Deputy Counsel for the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
It's a pleasure to introduce our esteemed guest today, New York City Sheriff Joe Fecito. Sheriff Fecito was appointed in 2014 after serving with the Sheriff's Office since 1988, when at 18, he became the youngest deputy sheriff in the city's history. He has served under five administrations and in all uniformed ranks within the agency: deputy sheriff, sergeant, lieutenant, undersheriff, and now sheriff. He has received numerous service citations, including the Sheriff's World Trade Center 9/11 Award, the Sheriff's Medal of Honor, and the Mayor's Office to Combat Domestic Violence Upstander Award. We had a really fascinating conversation with the sheriff, where he highlighted some of the most frightening, exciting, and unbelievable stories from his nearly four decades of service to the city. He also gave some great insight into the function and powers of the sheriff's office, which we didn't know a whole lot about beforehand. We hope you enjoy.
I want to welcome our next guest to City Hall Pass, somebody who I think many of you have been reading about in the papers quite a bit. He's all over the news. He really has been the city's Superman during the COVID crisis, and somebody I've come to get to know very well over the last 4 or 5 months. And he's just been a real great pleasure to get to know him and see what a terrifically talented human being he is, and what an exceptional job he does running his unit. And I'm speaking, of course, of Sheriff Joseph Fecito. Joe, welcome to City Hall Pass. We really appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Thank you very much. And I just, usually people do this at the end, but I want to do it in the beginning. I appreciate all the praise, but it's not just a one, you know, it's not a one-person show. And people asked me earlier, like, how did we get to where we were? It was literally decades of people. And I just want to give quick thanks up front. So obviously, Commissioner of Finance and the whole finance legal team, they support the sheriff's office in a tremendous fashion.
Sheriff, I feel like I should be handing you an award right now. It feels like, you know, one of those speeches you give after you win an Oscar, and you thank everyone who's really helped you in your life. But as always, Sheriff, you are a humble man, but I can tell everybody from having worked with you, you're just a terrific talent, and the city's very lucky to have you and your staff to help protect us and keep us safe. As we've seen during the COVID crisis, the work that you do is invaluable. I remember during one of our conversations, you described your unit as sort of the ultimate wingman for the city. And I always remember that, because anytime we have a problem, I always think about you, and I think about how you are the ultimate wingman and how you're always willing to jump into really difficult situations. I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about some of the more memorable experiences you've had in your career. Now, how long has your career been at the Sheriff's Department?
32 years.
In 32 years in the Sheriff's Department, I'm sure you've had boring days, but I'm sure you've also had your share of really exciting days. I think it'd be really interesting if you could share with us some of your more memorable moments.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you, I'll give you a selection. Do you want the scariest moment? Do you want one of the more interesting property seizures, the things that I'm most proud of? I'll let you pick.
Yeah, why don't we start in honor of Kate, who I think is a horror movie fan and likes scary things. Why don't we start with scary first?
Scariest one was very easy. I was 20 years old, and I was a deputy sheriff. And I was assigned to a special unit that doesn't exist anymore. Under the Koch administration, housing preservation and development used to go after landlords that didn't provide heat and hot water. It was a very big program under the Koch administration. And HPD used to send attorneys to court, and they would try to get these landlords to provide heat and hot water. And if they didn't, they would hold them in contempt, and they would get these arrest warrants that the sheriff would execute. And it was a much simpler time. It was myself and another deputy sheriff assigned to this unit with tremendous latitude and tremendous freedom, which I thought at 20 years old, I said, wow, they're entrusting me to do all this. So we would work with these attorneys, and they issued an arrest warrant for a woman in a very kind of complex case where she was also a 7A administrator and she was keeping the rents. So she had all these problems attached to it. And my partner at the time, I'm going to mention his name. His name was Raymond Reyes. He was a sergeant with the Las Vegas Police Department. I believe he's retired now, but Ray was a great partner. And we were assigned to go and arrest this woman. She lived in uptown Manhattan. We went uptown to look for her, and we got to the lobby of her building. And when we walked into the lobby, we saw a woman. We had a photograph, and we saw a woman that looked like her. We went over, we introduced ourselves, showed our shields, told her what we were there for, and she claimed not to be the defendant, and she said that that was her sister. So we talked a little bit, and we said, well, do you have ID to prove it? And she goes, I have it in my apartment. So we said, okay, let's give the woman the benefit of the doubt, and we followed her to her apartment. And as soon as we got in, I remember Ray was started getting very anxious because the apartment was decorated in the most bizarre fashion. So the walls were painted black. All the walls were painted black, and they had different types of like feathers on the wall and masks on the wall. It was very, very creepy. Now, at 20 years old, you think you're invulnerable. At 50, I would have been like, all right, I'm not going in there, right? But at 20, you believe that you're invulnerable and you can do anything. So Ray and I went in there, and she starts fumbling and trying to show us ID, and she can't produce the ID on time. Right. So after a while, we begin to realize she's just playing us. She's not her sister. She's the defendant. And we say, look, we believe you're the defendant and you got to come with us. So I take out my handcuff and I put one handcuff on her. So I have one of her arms handcuffed. All of a sudden, from like behind the black blankets, three guys appear and they say, she's not going anywhere with you. And we realize it's her sons, and they start arguing with us, and they shut the lights off.
Oh, so when you walk in, the lights are on, actually.
The lights were on when we walked in, and they shut the lights off and were in the dark, and they proceed to attack us. Ray tries to call for help over the radio, and back then we had a very, very unreliable system, but New York City, most people think is flat. It's actually hills and valleys, and the radio system we had was not able to transmit where we were. So we were there. We didn't have radio backup. So fortunately, Ray was a professional boxer. I was actually an amateur boxer. Ray was a professional boxer. And we decided that we had to punch our way out of it. And that's what we did. We kind of pulled her along, and we were getting hit in the dark. And I remember Ray was kind of punching some people back. And we got to the doorway, and Ray was fumbling to get the door open. And she was trying to get away from me, and I was pulling. And anybody that came near us, Ray would turn around and throw a punch in the dark, and sometimes it connected, sometimes it didn't. And I remember when we got out into the hallway, we all spilled out into the hallway, and I think I described it to you as like we were fish flopping in the hallway, right? So Ray is standing there in a boxer's pose telling them to get back. I'm trying to get her cuffed, and then we quickly get her handcuffed, get her into the car outside, and then we drive off with people like throwing stuff at the car, screaming at us. So I could tell you that my heart was in my throat. That was one of the scariest moments in my career. But at the same time, Ray and I were talking in the car afterwards. We both realized, without even talking with one another, that we didn't pull our weapons, because if we thought they were taken from us, we wouldn't be able to defend ourselves. And since they were just punching us, obviously they didn't have anything more. But it was a very scary experience. And I remember we got to court. The judge, we didn't realize all the background on the case. The judge in housing court didn't want to hear the case because the family had threatened her and she did not want to hear it. So she issued a commitment order to take her to jail. And attorneys for HPD actually did not show up in the matter. We were surprised at that, but the judge says he didn't care, and they put her in jail until she complied with the judge's order, which was to return money and make an accounting. And then on the way out, court officers stopped us and they said, look, we got to give you an escort. The entire family's outside. And when we walked out with her, the entire family rushed us, and the court officers were kind of pushing them back. I remember we put her in a car and we took her to Rikers Island, the Rose M. Singer building. That's where the female civil prisoners are housed in the city. And we committed her to the jail, and we got back to the office, and it was like a big whew. And then it sounds like we did everything wrong, which we probably did, if, you know, thinking back on how we acted. But that was the start of I should realize that I should plan things better. And that's how we started meticulously planning things in my head, that I need to gather all this information before I would go out and make an arrest like this. So, you know, you learn with experience. You know, the things you do at 20 are not the things you're going to do at 50.
This happened when you were 19 or 20. Is that right, Sheriff?
19 or 20.
You actually had a really interesting beginning to your career, right? Not only did you encounter this when you were 19 or 20, you actually had an interesting incident at Fordham University. Is that right?
Yes. That was not the scariest arrest. That was just one of the easiest arrests. We had to, when I was a young deputy, we had to arrest the dean of admissions for Fordham University Law School because he did not make an accounting to the surrogates court. And then ultimately we went to Fordham University in Manhattan, and we went to the office and we asked for the dean. And I was there with my training officer, who was much older, and it looked like father and son. And they thought we were there to talk about like enrolling in law school. And when we got inside, it was like, no, we have this warrant for arrest. We got to take you to the Kings County Surrogates Court. And we arrested him and we brought him to court. I remember the judge was particularly tough on him because he was an attorney. And he said, look, you were brought in here like a common criminal. I'm going to give you X amount of days to get the accounting done. If not, I'm going to send the sheriff to pick you up and put you directly in jail.
Wow, that's really interesting. What's the biggest seizure that you've ever been a part of?
We did a couple of seizures years ago for banks. They were running like $2 or $3 million. I couldn't tell you what the largest is for the sheriff's office, but I know that for a period of time, we were doing seizures in the Diamond District. And sometimes they were $1 million, sometimes $2 million. Unfortunately, this is a horrifying story for people. Whenever we would seize diamonds and we'd see a diamond ring and it would say, this diamond is like $10,000. When we would hire an appraiser, they would say, oh, that's what they sell people on the street. They're, you know, the industry, they're paying like $300 for it. So the markup is tremendous. I try to tell this to everybody. They don't believe me, but the markup on diamonds, like the ring that they're saying, look, it's $10,000. I'm going to give it for $8,000. They're only paying $300 in the industry for it.
So do you know any good diamond dealers in case I'm looking for some new earrings or something?
Unfortunately, the diamond dealers we've dealt with, we've had to take money and property. So I don't know how reliable.
So my dad, when he first came to this country, he couldn't speak a word of English. So one of the things he used to do was sell diamonds in the Diamond District. And you're absolutely right. The markup is insane. And I mean, he could not speak a word of English to save his life, but he made a lot of money. He was saying that it took him like several years, once he got a job as an engineer, to make the amount of money that he would make annually as a diamond, like not even like a diamond dealer. He was like on the street selling diamonds. Like he had diamonds, like trinkets, like on this mat. And it was literally like maybe a block and a half from City Hall where we're at right now. And he would just sit there. He would sell diamonds, like these little trinkets. And then he would sell like pens that were like sort of like, you know, upscale pens. And he didn't have to speak a word of English.
And you mentioned something that you've had to seize art before.
Yes. I think I was explaining one of the most interesting art seizures were a art seizure for, I think it was Citibank. They had given a $30 million loan to who ultimately became a defendant in their litigation. They gave him a $30 million loan. And part of the loan was that the artwork had to be stored in his apartment, which was in Trump Tower. That's the reason why the apartment was gorgeous. I'll tell you a little bit about it when I get to that part of the story. So we get this court order to go there and seize artwork. The background was that the defendant had pledged the artwork as collateral, and the bank was very satisfied with that. And it appears that the loan officer was an art aficionado, and he just happened to be reading an art magazine, and it talked about the seizure of art in the Netherlands by the taxing authority, and it was one of the pieces of art that had to be in Trump Tower. So they begin to panic, and they worry about, and then they discover that, I believe, that he triple pledged the artwork. So you got $30 million in art and you get $90 million in capital. That's a very good deal. And then you let everybody fight out, you know, who gets the art. So the bank was very keen on getting the artwork first. As you know, in America, whoever gets their hands on the property is probably in the better position than everybody else. So they ran down to Supreme Court, right? I think it's their commercial litigation term right here in Supreme New York. And they get an order of attachment and we truck up to Trump Tower. And when we get there, we show them a copy of the court order. We get up to the door. Fortunately, we didn't have to break in because they actually had like keys. The door was like a vault. It was like a steel door with like bars that went out through the top and the side. So we would have been there for like a long time trying to break in. So like we got inside. It was a double apartment. I'll never forget. It was, they took two apartments, broke down the wall, and it had a huge view, right? So I was like, wow, this is a beautiful apartment. And we had the right to search. They actually hired some art expert. I think she was a college professor. And she was like, they paid me $10,000 to come down here today. And I learned a little bit about, like, if you take the painting and you flip it over in pencil on the back, they initial who like appraised it or verified it. And all the names are written in this light pencil on the back, right? You pick up these things. We videotaped every piece of art. We photographed every piece of art. And then it had to be wrapped up, moved by like a professional moving company. And it was taken to an art storage warehouse, which was located on Walnut Avenue in the South Bronx. So you wouldn't believe the things that exist in like these deserted areas. You're like, there's an art warehouse here in the South Bronx. There's an art warehouse in the South Bronx. And we loaded it all up in the van. And since we were at that point, I think it was like $20 million in artwork. So we escorted the van all the way up to the warehouse, made sure that they loaded it in safely. Because the property is technically in the sheriff's custody. That's the interesting part of it. When it's an attachment, it's a prejudgment remedy. So the court isn't saying that it's absolutely the plaintiff's property. The court's saying, sheriff, take the property and hold it. So what happens is we technically are holding it for the court until they decide who's entitled to possession of the property. So the sheriff is always like the wingman, the middleman, the person that makes the things happen for the court system and other types of process.
Any paintings we would know or any famous artists?
Yes. When I was a kid, there was a silly game called Masterpiece that had all these like pictures in it. And I remember it because when I walked in, they had like a self-portrait of Rembrandt that was in the game. I don't know what it was worth, but you know, Rembrandt did self-portraits for all of his life, and that painting was hanging up in the guy's house.
You ever had any encounters with famous people?
Yes. I had to serve Geraldo Rivera. It was the skinhead fight. Remember that he had a TV show with his skinhead fight? Okay. So
when he had that bloody nose and everything?
Yeah. They were suing Geraldo Rivera, and he was a very nice gentleman. What happened was I kept going to his office, which was right off 42nd Street. I think it was 43rd Street on the west side somewhere, very close to the Port Authority bus terminal or one of those locations. And I remember I was a young deputy, and I had to go serve him with it. And I would go to his office, and of course, he was never around, right? He was never there. So I think it was my last attempt. I went up to go serve him, and I'm there. I'm talking with the secretary, and he just happens to come out of his office to, like, tell her something. And I'm like, oh, Mr. Rivera, hi. I'm Deputy Facito. I got these legal papers for you. And he was like, oh, yeah, that's great. Thank you. He was a gentleman. He was a very nice gentleman.
Hey there, and thanks for listening to City Hall Pass. I want to take a moment to remind our listeners who might be traveling into New York City to make sure and fill out the New York State Traveler Health Form. If you're traveling into the city from a state with a high infection rate, also known as a restricted state, you must complete the Traveler Health Form and quarantine for 14 days. Not sure where to find the form, or if that state you're traveling from is on the restricted list? Don't worry, we have you covered. Our office put together a detailed list of answers to frequently asked questions, providing you the proper guidance needed to ensure you comply with all of the safety measures. All you have to do is visit nyc.gov/COVID checkpoints. That's nyc.gov/COVID checkpoints. Thanks for listening.
You've definitely had some really unique experiences. I'm wondering, why did you decide to become a sheriff?
What happened was I was working at Orchard Beach, and NYPD were giving out flyers for the NYPD exam. And NYPD, they came to my wagon, they gave me a flyer, I was selling hot dogs, and I brought the flyer home, and my father said, hey, you should take that exam, you could take it at 16 years old. So I took my father's advice, and I took the exam. And I was too young to be a New York City police officer. They called me when I was like 17, and they said, look, you're too young, we'll call you when you're 21. When I was 18, I got a call from the sheriff. And I remember this. I was interviewed by the sheriff's counsel, right? They pulled me in and I was like very intimidated. And I remember my father saying, Joe, go for the interview. It's good experience, but you ain't going to get that job. You got to know somebody to get that job. So I was like, okay. But I went for the interview anyway. And what they explained to me during the interview was they used the NYPD list to hire deputy sheriffs. And what was going on was they were getting recruits. And the way the city hiring process works, when they certify a list, they certify the top portion of the list. So everybody in the top portion of the list was on the verge of being enrolled in the police department, right? They had gone through their background. They had done this. So when they were offered, do you want to be a deputy sheriff? They were like, nah, I never heard of it. I want to be a New York City. Who didn't want to be a New York City police officer, right? So what the sheriff at that time said was he noticed that they had a lot of candidates who were 18 that could not be eligible to be a New York City police officer. So they did the research and they found out you just need to be 18 to be a public officer in New York State. And so they asked DCAS to lower the age requirement to deputy sheriff to age 18, which it has not changed since. What's interesting is it has these higher educational requirements. You have to have a bachelor's degree, but the age requirement is still 18. So theoretically, if you have a bachelor's degree and 18 and you take the deputy sheriff exam, you could be hired. So I was hired because of these set of circumstances. They wanted to hire a deputy sheriff, and they felt, and I remember they told me this, they felt that if they got us here for a year or two, they would hook us for life because the job would be that interesting.
And that's true for you,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and it was very true. Very true.
So, Sheriff, what does, I mean, we've talked a little bit about some of your greatest hits, but the sheriff actually covers an enormous amount of space. And I think a lot of people who watch TV and the movies, they see the sheriff in like a small town and they associate the sheriff as someone with a lot of power. But here in New York City, I think when people think about law enforcement, they think about NYPD for just about everything. And one thing we've learned during the COVID crisis is just how extraordinary the sheriff's powers are. And the fact that the sheriff can basically do whatever you need from a law enforcement standpoint. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because when you showed me the statutes and the law involving the breadth of your powers, I was really taken aback. I had no idea, and I felt really foolish.
No, it's not. I mean, it's not something that everybody studies. I always like to make it clear. The sheriff is certainly not a replacement for the police department. We have the largest police force in the world, and they are really good at their job. Their origins, however, there's a piece of the sheriff in many different law enforcement agencies. So without boring the audience, there were once five county sheriffs, just like there were five DAs. And they decided in the 40s through a series of investigations that the city would be better served if all five sheriffs were consolidated into one agency and that the sheriff would focus on, you know, court enforcement work. Now, what's interesting is because the sheriff was a constitutional officer, they couldn't change some of the fundamental duties of the sheriff. And the two fundamental duties of the sheriff are to be an officer of the court and conservator of the peace, right? So conservator of the peace means just that. It's like basic policing. You know, if there's a riot, if there's a trouble, there's a crime, the sheriff has a duty to stop that. But for the most part, the sheriff's role is to carry out the court's mandates and process. Whereas you need a prosecutor sometimes to advance something, you need the police to take your complaint. But New York does allow people to pursue things to a certain degree on their own. And I think that's an important part of what the sheriff is about, carrying out the mandates of the court. All those words in the courthouse, what is it, the true administration, what is it, the best form of government is the true administration of justice. That all the court decisions in the world don't mean anything if you don't have anybody to enforce it. And that's the role of the sheriff. And it's not just court orders, it's any type of mandate. What does that mean? The mayor is empowered to issue mandates. So if he issued mandates and people said, well, I want to second guess this, I don't like that, then the mayor could never accomplish the mission he needs to accomplish. So the mayor's mandates are important. The court's mandates are important. And I think a lot of people don't realize a big confusion between the police and the sheriff. Much of what the police department does is discretionary. They have a lot of discretion. Most of what the sheriff does is ministerial. There is no discretion. It's to follow the mandate according to its command.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, you guys have done, again, we're going to shift to COVID in just a second, but you guys have done a lot of stuff. I mean, basically any crisis that the city has faced, over the last half century, the sheriff's been involved.
And did you have an interesting story around World War II?
World War II, an example of right after they created the city sheriff and they said, this is what your role is, they had the need to call upon the sheriff's police powers. So calling upon the sheriff's police powers is not something new. It's actually something very old. So Mayor LaGuardia, there was an issue with black marketeering of ration stamps. So during the war, they had ration stamps for like butter, milk, gasoline, and you received it and you couldn't buy a certain amount because you had to have a ration stamp. So there was black marketeering of the ration stamps. And I believe at the time, either Consumer Affairs or their forerunner agency, something with markets, were enforcing it, but they were having great difficulty because it was involving organized crime. So Mayor LaGuardia called up the sheriff at the time, John McCluskey, and said, I want you to investigate that. And the sheriff was able to do that, hitting the ground running without any special legislation. And that was key because the sheriff had this broad conservative peace authority. He can hit the ground running. And the sheriff did that. They investigated black marketeering in this field throughout World War II. And then obviously when the war was over, there was no need to continue the investigations anymore. But it shows that in moments in time when the city needed to get something and they needed somebody to act fast, they could go to the sheriff's office.
So speaking of moments in time, you know, something that's been in the news a lot recently is a possible union strike. Have you been involved in previous union strikes?
Yes, and the office has been involved in previous union strikes. So usually when there's a strike that's involving where they're going to go to court, the sheriff can sometimes be serving the injunction. We have famous or infamous stories. I believe that in the 1966 transit strike, the president, Mike Quill, was committed for contempt and the sheriff had to arrest him. Unfortunately, he had a heart attack while in sheriff's custody and he died several days later. But that's an example of usually the Taylor law, which is that public workers can't strike. It's enforced by the court. It's enforced by contempt. And a little background, contempt comes in two forms. There's criminal contempt and civil contempt. Criminal contempt is punitive, meaning that for every act, you get a definitive punishment. In family court, it can be up to 6 months, but in Supreme Court, it's just 30 days per act, right? Civil contempt, which sounds like the lesser offense, is actually the stronger one. You're incarcerated until you comply. So the theory is that if you incarcerate somebody and tell them to stop doing something, they'll do it because they want to get out of jail. And so in the last transit strike in the early 2000s, the court decided to hold the president of the Transit Workers Union in contempt, a gentleman named Toussaint, who was a very nice gentleman. I met him. Unfortunately, I had to arrest him for contempt of court. But that's an example of that if you don't follow the court's direction, it's the sheriff that carries out that type of process.
So before we jump into the work that your office and that you have done in COVID, this is unfortunately not the first kind of major incident in New York or in this country. You were at the sheriff's office during 9/11. What was your role during the recovery?
Obviously, during 9/11, everybody participated, NYPD, fire department. I mean, they put a tremendous amount of resources. During that period of time, OEM took a strong lead on coordinating the support services for the rescue operations. And our role was really logistics. We did a tremendous amount of transportation. It sounds like it was a very humble job, but it's an important part of the structure. So an example would be every day they would photograph Ground Zero. They'd have a helicopter go up and photograph Ground Zero. So one of the assignments for the sheriff's office was every day deputies would pick up this pilot and a photographer, bring them to a heliport. They would get in, they would photograph Ground Zero, and then the deputies would take the film and bring it to OEM for development. They did that every day for whatever it was, 3 or 4 months. They wanted to see day by day what type of progress they were seeing at Ground Zero. Fire, I mean, it could be a whole host of reasons, but they were photographing it every day. Some other things that we did during that period of time, a fuel truck had to be brought down to Ground Zero. So NYPD and fire put tremendous resources into the rescue and recovery operation. So they needed somebody to do the logistical support. And so we had deputy sheriffs would meet the oil truck, bring them down to Ground Zero. And then they had some assignments where we escorted out-of-state fire companies in case they had to go to a fire because they weren't familiar with New York City. So we assigned deputies to do that. So a little bit of everything. That's the only way I can describe it, that we did a little piece of everything during the 9/11 event.
So Sheriff, we've been working a lot with your office on COVID and the response to COVID. And something I've been working on somewhat with you was checkpoints and the possibility of quarantining people. And on an email we were both on, someone asked, well, have we ever had to commit someone or issue a mandatory isolation order? And you cited Typhoid Mary's.
Yes. I mean, that was a long time ago, but that's a perfect example of if you commit acts that are so egregious and it's a public health crisis that you can be committed. The Typhoid Mary case was a very old case where they committed a woman civilly. They determined that she was a carrier of typhus, I believe. I think that's the nomenclature. And she was working as a cook, and she wouldn't stop working as a cook. Even though they said, look, you're working as a cook is a grave danger to people that you're cooking for, and she continued to cook. And I believe they committed her twice over the course of 20 years because she continued to cook even though she was spreading typhoid to other people, which is, that's a perfect example of somebody who completely disregards health code for whatever reason, whether they believe that they're immune or that they believe that they're not infecting everyone. You know, sometimes authorities have the right to commit someone because it's in the interest of public safety. Some of the reporters asked me questions like, could you ever see it happening here if there was something egregious? Let's say somebody was having a party where they were specifically going to infect people with COVID-19, right? That would be an example, and there was no way to stop them. That would be an example of when you would use these remedies to stop people from doing these things, right? Because a ticket doesn't stop somebody from doing anything. Remember, criminal actions are punitive. They punish you for after the fact. There has to be a remedy to stop it before you do it, an immediate remedy. And that's when you would use these immediate type of civil remedies to stop it before it happens, as opposed to letting it happen.
So you haven't committed any, quote, Typhoid Marys, but have you come across anyone with a Typhoid Mary attitude?
No, I mean, for the most part, most people have been cooperative and understanding. I mean, we did issue summonses to people who didn't comply with the traveler's checkpoint material, and that was after exhaustive dialogue with them to complete it. But for the most part, people understand that they have to do this.
Don't you think checkpoints in particular are, for your staff, some of the more dangerous things that you do? I've always, when I was a prosecutor, one of the things officers used to always tell me is the scariest 2 minutes of their day was when they pulled somebody over because they never knew who was going to roll down the window. And I think people that get pulled over, as a person who has been pulled over, I think we often feel scared, but I think people don't understand law enforcement feel, I think, relatively scared as well when they pull over. Even though most of them have guns, it is a scary couple of minutes as you're walking up to somebody's window.
It is very scary. Unfortunately, I can't rate the scariness because a lot of things the sheriff does is scary. Car stops are scary. If you go statistically, the process that's the most dangerous for sheriffs in New York are evictions, okay? More deputy sheriffs have been killed in New York State doing evictions and nationwide than other types of process. You wouldn't believe that. In fact, the sheriff of Queens County, a gentleman named Steyer, he was killed, I don't know if it was 1914 or 1960. The sheriff himself was killed on an eviction. He went to do an eviction in a very unusual circumstance. The gentleman came out with a shotgun and shot the sheriff in one shot and killed him immediately. Turned into a standoff, NYPD was involved. But evictions have a lot of there's a volatile aspect. People blame the sheriff. As I told people, we're just the mailman on the eviction. The bank, the person behind it, they're the one. But the sheriff is the one that delivers the bad news. And I think evictions are dangerous. Car stops are very dangerous because people don't know why you're stopping them. They see a sheriff car. Are they stopping me because I have drugs in the car? Or are they stopping me to ask questions about COVID-19 or something else? So car stops are dangerous. When everything is dangerous, it's very hard to categorize what's the most dangerous. But it is a dangerous process to stop vehicles. We do use, you know, it's the same training that we use for any other, or other types of vehicle stops. We have two deputy sheriffs. They're always observing. They put themselves out, so we have the vehicle and the plate number. We have all these components that go into a regular car stop. The only thing that's missing from it is we're not using this as a criminal exploratory search in any way. Our stops are very narrowly tailored to perform the specific governmental objective.
Do you ask someone their immigration status when you pull them over?
Absolutely not.
Sheriff, a lot of what you do now relates to social distancing and including people wearing face coverings. I think during the checkpoints, you've handed out hundreds, if not thousands, of face coverings.
12,000 masks so far.
Yeah, I think you have been a real proponent and supporter of the mayor's policies regarding education over enforcement, really trying to educate New Yorkers about the necessity for face coverings, the necessity to stay 6 feet apart, because it works, and versus just issuing people summons. And I know you have issued a lot of summons to people, but I know you've only done so really as a last resort. And that's your mentality going into any interaction that you have with a fellow New Yorker. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. Most of the summonses we issued was when it was egregious and also a companion to other criminal activity. So for the most part, education is important. You know, businesses that are doing something, if they're not doing it correctly, we gave out thousands of warnings. The ticket book was not the first choice. When did we decide that somebody had to make an arrest or do something? When the issue is so compounded by the person's actions. So you're not social distancing. You're not getting a liquor license. You're not doing this. You got five or six things. You're not doing any of the things that you're supposed to do, right? That's when we say, okay, this has become egregious now, and you have to be accountable for each of these actions. Your social distancing, and let's say, example, these clubs like raves. This was illegal before the pandemic, right? You should be even more cognizant that you shouldn't be running this during a pandemic. So not only do you get the summonses for the alcohol beverage control law violations, but you get the social distancing summons. You should know that you shouldn't be doing this. You can't do this during normal times. You certainly can't do it during a pandemic. So that's kind of the approach. We don't want to target the everyman. It's the egregious. We want cooperation. It has to do with safety and getting people to be aware. Self-discipline is the best type of discipline.
Yeah, and in fact, you've broken up a lot of parties over the last you've been sort of the party police over the last few months, which I know isn't a fun job, but you and your deputies have encountered some pretty interesting parties over the last couple of months.
Sheriff, we heard you broke up a sex party.
Yes, that was, and again, we just came to the conclusion that you couldn't comport to social distancing by having a sex party. We asked everyone to leave.
In your legal judgment.
Yes. And then the participants we asked to leave, and they didn't get a summons, but the coordinator, the promoter did. The people who were party promoters, and it was in conjunction with a whole series of other criminal activity. So this enforcement was more about education, and the people that we arrested, they were going to get arrested for other things anyway. They just compounded their problems by creating a social distancing nightmare in what they were doing.
You know, Sheriff, you shared with us a lot of really interesting insights about your career, how you started, why you became a sheriff. Or a deputy sheriff, undersheriff, and then the sheriff of New York City. And in your 32 years of serving this city, you've done a lot of terrific things. What do you hope they say about you and your legacy?
That I was a strong advocate for domestic violence victims. I didn't even talk about it here, but one of the things that I believe strongest in is family court. We developed a program at the sheriff's office where we serve orders of protection and we arrest individuals who don't obey family court orders of protection. And we have a very, very, just like we developed the process for the checkpoints, we developed a very, very strong process for orders of protection. And I just want to highlight this because to me, that's the most, out of anything I've ever done in the sheriff's office, that's the most important thing that I ever contributed to. And that's what I'd like to be remembered for.
Sheriff, we want to thank you for taking time to come talk to all of us. We know how busy you are, but I think your stories today, the story of your life and the things that you all are doing on an everyday basis, including what you just talked about, domestic violence program, and making sure that our residents are protected in every which way. I think on behalf of the city, we want to thank you very much for your service. And we're very, very lucky to have you. And thanks so much for taking time to speak with us.
It's my honor to serve. And that's a true statement. I don't want to come off as being a saint. I'm a normal person. I always say the sheriff walks among mortals, right? I'm not the court system. I deal with the same problems, the same things as anybody else. I'm just very grateful to serve in any way I can.
Thanks so much, Sheriff.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Well, there you go. I don't think there's a better storyteller in city government than the sheriff. We want to send him a big thank you for taking the time to engage with us today. And as always, thank you all for listening.
This podcast is brought to you by the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor of New York City, with support from the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Special thanks to our executive producer, Stathi, and a big thank you to Karen, Roland, and Andrew from the Mayor's Office of Media Entertainment. We couldn't do this without you.